dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva and WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. What do radical labor unionists at the previous turn of the century have to do with Colombian agricultural workers at the turn of the millennium? The repression of the former by U.S. state power has enabled the expansion of a global empire that has impoverished billions in the name of profits for a few, and turned paradises into toxic wastelands in the quest for the quick buck. Tonight we're going to conclude our series of readings in the history of the repression of the radical labor movement in America, whose goal was to end the empire of greed. In our second hour, we'll hear an interview with a Colombian human rights worker about how this same globalized empire has reduced workers to poverty and poisoned her nation's best farmland in order to grow flowers for export. We'll begin the program with a lecture by Dr. Michael Parenti titled "The National Security State at Home and Abroad," which establishes the context, the use of state power, both military and police, in the protection of the ability of the corporate elite to make the world their oyster. Dr. Parenti is the author of more than a dozen books, including Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, and The Sword and the Dollar. Michael Parenti.
Within the government, there exists what some have called the national security state. It consists of the president, the Secretaries of State, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is the military heads of all the various armed forces, and numerous intelligence agencies like the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA. The National Security State often operates like an unaccountable sovereign power of its own. Its primary function is to defeat political forces that seek alternatives to free market capitalism, at home or abroad, or even forces that might try to introduce any kind of economically redistributive politics even within the existing capitalist framework. U.S. national security agencies involve themselves in political repression at home and abroad. We often think that the United States is free of the kind of political crimes, assassinations, and death squads that characterize other countries. Well, think again. The U.S. national security agencies ally themselves with criminal elements, either looking the other way when thugs and assassins do their dirty business, or actively assisting them in third world countries, in Europe, and even in the U.S. When agents of the Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos conducted operations against Filipino dissidents in the U.S., the FBI cooperated with these agents. One known FBI informant admitted to having witnessed the murder of two Filipino union leaders who were prominent in the anti-Marcos movement in this country. The FBI also cooperated with El Salvador's security forces, supplying them with the names of Salvadoran refugees who were about to be deported from the U.S. so that the security police could apprehend them upon their return. In other words, the FBI would give the names to the Salvadoran security police. Many of these refugees had fled to this country in the hope of escaping death and torture. Salvadoran activists in this country have endured assaults, kidnappings, and numerous car smashings and apartment break-ins, with threatening notes left after them, and relatives in El Salvador threatened by police. The U.S. police hardly bestirred themselves, making no attempts to question right-wing suspects. Individuals in the Cuban-American community who have advocated a more conciliatory policy toward the Cuban communist government have been subjected to threats and attacks. an anti-socialist Cuban exile terrorist group, claimed credit for some 21 bombings between 1975 and 1980. They would leave messages after the bombing. And for the murder of a Cuban diplomat in New York. And yet this group escaped arrest in all but two instances. A car bombing in Miami that cost a Cuban radio news director both his legs also remains unsolved. Likewise, three Haitian talk show hosts in Miami who aired critical commentaries about military repression in Haiti were shot dead between 1991 and 93. In the United States, between 1981 and 87, there were 11 fatal shootings of Vietnamese publishers, journalists, and activists who had advocated normalized relations with the communist government of Vietnam. In each instance, a U.S.-based group called Vietnamese Organization to Exterminate Communists and Restore the Nation claimed responsibility. One of the group's victims, a publisher of a Vietnamese language weekly, survived his shooting and identified the gunman, a leader of a Vietnamese extortion gang. The assailant was convicted, but the conviction was reversed at the prosecutor's request. The prosecutor, because, quote, he had no prior criminal record in this country. So you can murder somebody or attempt to murder somebody and you had no prior criminal record, the prosecutor lets you off. The police repeatedly claimed that such attacks were unrelated and devoid of a political motive, even though all the victims were people who were politically active in the Vietnam issue. And despite Vietnamese Organization to Exterminate Communists, despite their communiques claiming responsibility, they even claimed they were killing these people for political reasons, and yet the U.S. police said they could not see a pattern and they didn't really see any political motive. The FBI refused to get involved. There's the strange case of Professor Edward Cooperman, an American, who was shot dead while working in his office at California State University Fullerton. As founder of an organization advocating scientific cooperation with Vietnam, Cooperman had received death threats. One Lam Van Meen, a Vietnamese emigre and Cooperman's former student, admitted witnessing the professor's death and was arrested. As Meen tells it, Cooperman produced a gun that accidentally discharged and killed him. Meen left in a panic, taking the gun with him. Isn't that strange? He then took a female friend to a movie, after which he returned to Cooperman's office and placed the gun in Cooperman's hand. This is Meen's testimony. The office had the appearance of a struggle, which Meen's attorney argued resulted merely from the professor's attempts to get up after being left for dead. The prosecution introduced little to dispute Meen's improbable story. It was again a very lackadaisical prosecution. He was convicted only of involuntary manslaughter and sentenced to 3 years, and he served only 1 year. It should be pointed out that Meen had been previously arrested for possession of stolen property, at which time police found guns and ammunition in his car and home. Meen's lawyer was procured by Tran Minh Cong, spokesman for the right-wing National United Front for the Liberation of the Vietnam, a right-wing group that has terrorized Vietnamese. In 1987, after a bombing that killed a Vietnamese language publisher in Garden Grove, California, police finally acknowledged the existence of right-wing Vietnamese terrorism and officially requested FBI assistance. The Bureau launched an investigation to determine, quote, whether a pattern is emerging. Can you imagine if there were killings by some leftists? Would they wait for years and years and say there's no pattern? Other political murders or suspicious deaths in the United States include Manuel de Dios, a reporter and editor who frequently pointed the finger at big drug dealers and money launderers. There was Alan Berg, a popular Denver talk show host who engaged in impassioned arguments with anti-Semitic and racist callers and who was shot by members of a white supremacist group. There was Don Bowles, who at the time of his murder was involved in an investigation of a far-reaching financial scandal said to implicate some of Arizona's most powerful political and business leaders. There was Karen Silkwood, who was investigating radiation safety negligence at Kerr-McGee Corporation. And there was Danny Casolaro, whose investigation of government and business corruption might have implicated high-ranking officials. Casolaro was judged a suicide, even though he was found dead in a hotel room in the bathtub, and he was immediately embalmed before any kind of autopsy could be done on him, despite the family wanting to investigate. And his family argued that he was not at all depressed and was not going to commit suicide, didn't like the sight of blood, and was very excited about the investigation that he was doing into government and business corruption. None of these murders have been thoroughly investigated. None of them have been solved. In contrast, the FBI was quick to make arrests when environmentalist Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney were seriously injured by a car bomb in 1990. They acted very quickly. They arrested the victims, Barry and Cherney, calling them, quote, radical activists. They charged that the bomb must have belonged to them. They were carrying it in the car. But the bomb didn't blow up in the back. It was under the seats where they were driving. Barry is an outspoken advocate of nonviolence. The FBI said the bomb was in the back, and the photos show the back of the car was undamaged. The explosion was in the front. As I said, Barry, her real crime was that she was an outspoken advocate of nonviolence, and she was an outspoken activist against the timber companies that were stripping and destroying the land. The charges were eventually dropped against Barry and Cherney for total lack of evidence, but the FBI named no other suspects and came up with nothing else. Just don't have a clue as to who could have tried to kill Barry and Cherney. And by the way, both of them still suffering from disabilities from the bombing. Neo-Nazi skinheads and other rightist terrorists have repeatedly been able to commit acts of violence and even publicly claim responsibility without getting caught. This means law enforcers have made little effort to monitor and deter their actions, unlike the way they monitor legal, peaceful groups on the left. Because if they were monitored, if they were under surveillance, if they'd been infiltrated, their acts of violence would have been stopped and they would have been caught and revealed and prosecuted, one would hope. Again, there's nothing inconsistent about this position, by the way, because left groups, no matter how nonviolent and how lawful, they challenged the corporate system of power, money, and privilege, or some aspect of its abuses, while right-wing groups generally do the dirty work for that very same system. Thus, there's a community of interest between the far-rightists, these little cliques, these skinheads and terrorists, and the law agencies, and often also a community of methods. Right-wingers can get into trouble sometimes when right-wing extremists engage in counterfeiting and bank robberies and plan attacks against police and military bases as part of a war against the government, then law enforcers may move against them. But when they act against individual citizens or progressive people, they seem to get away with murder, literally. Making the world safe for free market capitalism is a massive enterprise. Security agencies expend about an estimated $28 billion to $30 billion yearly on operations at home and abroad. Congress has no exact idea how much it allocates because the funds for intelligence operations are hidden in other budget items, and this is in violation of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9 of which reads, "No money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequences of appropriations made by law and a regular statement account of receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time." And in fact, that is not at all done with security agencies. Of the various units of the national security state, the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, is the most widely known, probably because of its extensive covert actions throughout the world. In addition, there's the Pentagon's National Security Agency, NSA, created in 1952 by President Truman in an executive order that has remained secret to this day. NSA's mission is to break codes and monitor nearly all telephone calls and telegrams between the United States and other countries, and a great deal of domestic telephone traffic. They do it all through these satellites. There's the Pentagon Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, which deals with military espionage and counterintelligence around the world. There's the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. There's the FBI's counterintelligence program. Within the Pentagon itself, every echelon, be it the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Army, Navy, Air Force, or the regional commands around the globe, or base units, each one of them has its own intelligence service with its own security, communications, and support services. While supposedly protecting us from foreign threats, the various intelligence agencies spend a good deal of time policing and propagating views among the U.S. public. They have admitted they maintain surveillance on members of Congress, the White House, the Treasury, and Commerce Departments. They become a state within the state. They've maintained surveillance on vast numbers of private citizens. They have planted stories in the U.S. media to support their counterinsurgency view of the world, secretly enlisting the cooperation of newspaper owners, media network bosses, and hundreds of journalists and editors. The CIA alone has subsidized the publication of hundreds of books and has owned outright more than 230 or so wire services, newspapers, magazines, and book publishing complexes, according to a Senate Intelligence Committee report. The CIA has recruited some 5,000 academicians from across the country as spies and researchers, secretly financing and censoring their work. CIA agents participate in academic conferences, and the agency conducts its own resident scholar programs. It even recruits students on the campus. It offers internships and tuition assistance to undergraduate and graduate students while they're still attending school. Intelligence agencies have infiltrated and financed student, labor, scientific, and peace groups. The CIA has financed research on mind control drugs, sometimes on unsuspecting persons, and was responsible for the death of at least one government employee. In violation of the National Security Act of 1947, which says that the CIA, quote, shall have no police subpoena, law enforcement, or internal security functions, because Congress was afraid of building up a secret military police in our own country. It's okay for them to work that way in other countries, but not here. Despite that stricture in that Security Act of 47, the agency has equipped and trained local police forces in the U.S. Under President Reagan's executive order, the CIA was authorized to conduct domestic surveillance and covert operations against U.S. citizens both in the United States and abroad. And in fact, you're listening to one of those citizens right now. Under the Freedom of Information Act, I got a file from my FBI, and it had a whole section from the CIA. At least the CIA told me they sent it to the FBI. The order, still in effect as of 1994-95, also authorizes intelligence agencies to train and support local police and enter secret contracts with corporations, academic institutions, other organizations, and individuals for the provision of services and goods. This is President Reagan's executive order I'm talking about, which President Clinton is living with quite comfortably. U.S. intelligence agencies have perpetrated terrible crimes against the peoples of other nations. In countries like Guatemala, Greece, Brazil, Chile, Indonesia, Argentina, Zaire, the Philippines, U.S. national security forces have used military intervention, terror, sabotage, bribery, propaganda, and assassination to bring down populist or democratically elected governments and install reactionary dictatorships friendly to U.S. corporate interests. Countries that embarked upon popular revolutions, such as Nicaragua, Mozambique, and Angola, found their economies and peoples devastated by the murderous assaults of U.S.-supported mercenary armies. In Angola, over 1.5 million people have been killed in a CIA-supported civil war against the progressive government of Angola and its people. The CIA has sabotaged and stolen elections abroad. The CIA has waged massive disinformation campaigns, infiltrated and fractured trade union movements of other nations. It has funded and trained secret armies, paramilitary forces, torture squads, and death squads. And the CIA has pursued destabilization and assassination campaigns against labor, peasant, religious, clergy, and student organizations in numerous nations. Now, these squads don't kill at random. They kill those people who are in any way trying to better the lot of the poor against the privileges of the rich. After World War II, U.S. intelligence agencies put thousands of Nazi war criminals and their collaborators on the U.S. payroll, utilizing them in repressive operations against the left in Latin America and elsewhere. Murderers, far from being exempted from such protection, seem to have been among those most likely to obtain this protection. A network of Eastern European fascists, anti-Semites, racists, and Nazi collaborators found a home in the ethnic outreach program of the Republican Party. George Bush, in fact, in the 1992 campaign, had to get rid of a few of them when it finally made the national media. U.S. intelligence agencies have used mobsters, drug dealers, and warlords in their war against those who resist the encroachments of global corporatism. The CIA supplied arms and money to the Italian and Corsican mafias to beat and murder members of communist-led dock workers' unions in Italy and France. After these unions were broken, the mobsters, and they were broken with terror and violence and murder, the mobsters were given a freer hand in transporting tons of heroin each year from Asia to Western Europe and North America. The CIA buttressed anti-communist warlords in Southeast Asia and Afghanistan, whose opium production increased tenfold soon after the agency moved into these regions, according to the Washington Post. Likewise, CIA involvement in Central America contributed to the U.S. cocaine epidemic of the 1980s. CIA planes transported guns and supplies down to right-wing mercenary troops in Nicaragua and pro-capitalist military leaders in other countries. The planes then were reloaded with narcotics for the return trip to the United States. This, by the way, is a matter of public record and is a finding of at least three congressional investigative committees. CIA operatives participated with mafia associates and business and political leaders to profit from the multi-billion dollar savings and loan swindles. Monies gained from such deals, along with drug money laundered through various banks and other financial institutions, were illegally used to finance CIA covert activities and line the pockets of various people in the field. There exists enormous evidence, a mountain of evidence accumulated over 30 years, suggesting that elements of the intelligence community, assisted by certain mobsters, were involved in the assassination of President John Kennedy in 1963 and in the subsequent massive cover-up. Kennedy was considered a dangerous liability by the intelligence community and right-wing groups because of what were perceived as his liberal foreign and domestic policies, including his unwillingness to pursue an all-out ground war in Indochina and escalate the war, his determination to bring the intelligence community under tighter controls, and his other various policies. His pursuit of a rapprochement with the Soviet Union was also another consideration which incurred the ire of right-wing groups. If, in fact, there was no conspiracy, why has there been so much cover-up? Why have the archives been sealed for 60, 70, 80 years? And why so much official resistance against opening them? If there's nothing to hide, what are they hiding? X-rays? Mrs. Kennedy's description of the wounds and the shots? Oswald's links with military intelligence? Even Oswald's tax returns? On and on and on we could go. In 1982, at the urging of the Reagan administration, Congress passed a law that made it a crime to publish any information that might lead to the disclosure of the identities of present and past intelligence agents and informers, even if the information came from already published sources. What this means is that under the law, some journalistic exposures of illegal covert activities themselves become illegal. It's been argued that a strong intelligence system is needed to gather information for policymakers. It will be safer and more secure that way. But the CIA and some other agencies have been involved in something more than just gathering information. They've been involved in covert actions that go beyond intelligence gathering and any lawful mandate. They've been involved in economic and military sabotage, disinformation campaigns directed against the U.S. public itself, drug trafficking, and mercenary wars, assassinations, and other terrorist acts against numerous nations and literally tens and hundreds of thousands of people. Let me quote what one former CIA officer wrote, his name Ralph McGehee, in a book called Deadly Deceits. Quote, "My view, backed by 25 years of experience, is that quite simply that the CIA is the covert action arm of the presidency. Much of its money, manpower, and energy go into covert operations that include backing dictators and overthrowing democratically elected governments. The CIA uses disinformation, much of it aimed at the U.S. public, to mold opinion. But if the agency actually reported the truth about the Third World, what would it say?" I'm still quoting McGehee. He goes on. He says, "It would say that the United States installs foreign leaders, arms their armies, and empowers their police to help these leaders repress an angry, defiant people. That the CIA-empowered leaders represent only a small fraction who kill, torture, and impoverish their own people to maintain their position of privilege. The CIA plants weapons, shipments, forges documents, broadcasts false propaganda, and transforms reality. Thus, it creates a new reality that it then believes." Unquote. What we should do and what Congress should do is abolish the CIA and the entire national security state. Congress should drastically cut the budgets of national security agencies, limit their mandates to intelligence gathering, prohibit gangster covert actions against third world social movements, and impeach those executive officers who fail to obey the lawful limits imposed on them. The power of the executive to act with criminally violent effect against various peoples throughout the third world and throughout the world, including our own people here at home, this power should be exposed, challenged, and stopped. The Freedom of Information Act should be enforced instead of undermined by those who say they have nothing to hide, then try to hide almost everything they do. End the U.S.-sponsored counterinsurgency wars against the poor of the world. We need to eliminate all foreign aid to regimes engaged in oppression of their own peoples. The billions of U.S. tax dollars that flow into the Swiss bank accounts of foreign autocrats and militarists could be better spent on human services here at home. Lift the trade and travel bans imposed on Cuba and other countries that have dared to deviate from the free market orthodoxy. Under the guise of fighting communism and quote, protecting U.S. interests, the purveyors of state power have committed horrendous crimes against the people of this and other countries, violating human rights and the Constitution in order to make the world safe for privilege and power. The ancient question of political philosophy, who guards the guardians, remains with us. The national security state continues to operate like a state within the state, a law unto itself, and it should be abolished in the name of democracy.
That was Michael Parenti speaking on the national security state at home and abroad. For more information on the lectures and writings of Dr. Parenti, check out his website at www.michaelparenti.org.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, live as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake, Joe, great God, says I, am standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests. I'm Chris Sturr. Next, we'll conclude our reading of The Rise and Repression of Radical Labor by Daniel Fussfeld, a history of the labor movement in the United States from 1877 to 1918. Last week, we read Act 3, which recounted in detail the anthracite coal strike of 1902. That strike provided an example of how conservative unions, corporate liberals, and government officials developed a policy of collective bargaining in labor-business relations, which required the repression of radical labor and ruled out challenges to the capitalist system. This week we'll read Act 4, entitled The Crushing of Radical Labor, which discusses the U.S. labor movement in the early 20th century until 1918. We will hear about the consolidation of anti-union business forces in organizations like the National Association of Manufacturers and the Citizens Industrial Association, the attack on the radical Western Federation of Miners in Colorado, the founding of the Industrial Workers of the World, also known as the Wobblies, and their aim to organize one big union of all workers, and the systematic and coordinated campaign involving both business and government at the local, state, and federal levels to crush the IWW. Finally, we will hear the book's epilogue, in which Fussfeld draws lessons about the failure of radical, class-conscious labor activism in the U.S. The problem was not that such a movement never developed. The history Fussfeld recounts shows that it certainly did, but instead that it lost momentum because of systematic repression, largely by the power of the national state.
And standing there just as big as life, smiling with his eyes, says he what they forgot to kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego on up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, says he, you'll find Joe Hill, says he, you'll find Joe Hill. Yeah, dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, live as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead, it never died, says he, I never died, says he.
Act 4, The Crushing of Radical Labor. During the relatively strong surge of prosperity from 1897 to 1903, membership in labor unions, chiefly the craft unions of the AFL and the railroad brotherhoods, increased from about 500,000 to almost 2 million. This growth was marked by considerable strife. According to the 1907 annual report of the U.S. Commissioner of Labor, there were 1,056 strikes at 3,809 business establishments in 1898. By 1903, those numbers had risen to 3,494 strikes affecting over 20,000 establishments. The 1902 anthracite strike was only the most spectacular of many work stoppages in that era of prosperity and union growth. The anti-union element in the business community reacted strongly. Business firms in a number of cities began around 1900 to organize employers' associations designed to present a united front in opposition to the local organizations of trade unions. These associations were committed to the idea of the open shop, the right to hire anyone, whether a union member or not. They were opposed to all labor unions and the idea of trade agreements arrived at through union management negotiations. By 1902, strong local employers' associations were found throughout the Midwest between the Appalachians and the Rockies. In 1903, this movement came to dominance in the National Association of Manufacturers, which became the chief spokesman for the open shop and the chief opponent of the collective bargaining philosophy of the National Civic Federation. From its founding in 1895, the NAM had been a rather mild organization of business firms whose chief activities were in support of tariff protection for domestic industry and expansion of U.S. exports, programs that were supported by a number of unions as well. The NAM had opposed national legislation to provide for an 8-hour day on all federal contracts and to exempt labor disputes from injunctions issued by federal courts, but these were not major elements of its program. However, in 1903, David M. Perry, president of a large carriage manufacturing company in Indianapolis, was elected president of the NAM. He was unalterably opposed to unions and was a leader of the open shop movement. At the 1903 annual meeting, he attacked labor unions, including by implication the craft unions of the AFL, as mob power and socialistic, and called for an employers' campaign against union abuses and labor-sponsored legislation. Ironically, this call to action was followed by a mild speech by U.S. Commissioner of Labor Carol D. Wright, pleading for businessmen to understand the new relationship between capital and labor, a thinly disguised statement of the philosophy of collective bargaining that had triumphed in the recent anthracite strike. But Wright's speech was followed by passage of a series of resolutions embodying Perry's ideas, a 9-point declaration of principles that set the NAM's course in opposition to labor unions and collective bargaining. This action was followed later in 1903 by organization of the Citizens Industrial Association, also headed by Perry, as a national organization to provide leadership to the local employers' associations, open to all employers and not just manufacturers. The anti-union conservative wing of the business community was now organized. The first fruit of the new militancy on the part of employers was an attack on the Western Federation of Miners in Colorado. James H. Peabody, governor of Colorado in 1903 to 1905, organized a campaign to break the power of the WFM in the mining areas of the state. He acted in concert with the large mining corporations, most of which were dominated by Eastern capital, with local employers' associations, and, where they were agreeable, with local governmental authorities. The pattern of action was as follows, with some variations due to local conditions. An industrial dispute develops between the mining company and the WFM. Employer intransigence triggers a strike. Local authorities ask for state assistance in maintaining order, even though there may have been little or no disorder. The governor declares martial law and sends in the National Guard, made up of volunteers recruited for that particular mission and usually paid for by the affected mining companies. The guard and local police protect strikebreakers brought in by the employers, and the mines start operating again. The union leaders are arrested and either tried or jailed or deported from the area with a warning not to return. Thus, law and order was sustained and Colorado made safe for capital investment. This pattern was repeated in one mining center after another, culminating in Cripple Creek in 1904. Within 2 years, the Western Federation of Miners in Colorado was largely a paper organization. Colorado showed what could be done when the power of government was directed toward suppression of radical unionism. The events in Colorado, however, helped to foster the organization of a national, class-oriented, radical labor organization, the Industrial Workers of the World. After its 1904 defeat in Colorado, the leadership of the WFM decided to move toward, quote, the amalgamation of the entire working class into one general organization, end quote. After some preliminary meetings with like-minded labor leaders in other organizations, the IWW was organized in June of 1905. It was to be a single union of all workers in all industries, with decision-making in the hands of the membership as a whole, and based on the ideas of irrepressible conflict between capital and labor. The chief organizers of the IWW were the leaders of the WFM and its spin-off, the American Labor Union. But it also included Daniel DeLeon's Socialist Trade and Labor Alliance, other socialists, and a number of other left labor people. The new organization immediately split into two factions, one interested chiefly in organization of workers, particularly the unskilled, and the other more concerned with developing a radical socialist program. After 3 years of struggle, the quote-unquote Overalls Brigade won out over the socialist intellectuals, who largely dropped out of the organization. By 1908, the IWW had become what its founders had intended, an instrument for organizing the working class as a whole and carrying on a class struggle against capitalism. Just as the organization itself had emerged from working class efforts and experience over more than a quarter century, so did its structure and program. The IWW was a highly democratic organization, attempting to reach out equally to all workers everywhere, with a one-person, one-vote approach to decision-making by the membership as a whole, which was difficult to put in practice and sometimes quite cumbersome. Its organizational structure reflected its ideals and philosophy of democratic class action, however. Its program had a similar emphasis. The IWW envisaged a syndicalist organization of the economy, including direct worker control and management of individual enterprises, coordinated and planned at higher administrative levels by workers' representatives. The chief basis of the IWW's attraction for workers, however, was its militant action program of class opposition to employers. The IWW appealed to the most heavily exploited groups among working people, those not represented by the craft unions of skilled workers in the AFL, bypassed by socialist intellectuals, and largely unrepresented politically, because many were migratory workers. In the West, the IWW concentrated its efforts on mining, lumbering, and agriculture. In the East, chiefly in textiles and rubber. It used new methods, organizing on the job, mass meetings in public parks and on city streets, endless chain mass picketing, and sit-down strikes on the job, as well as mass demonstrations reminiscent of 1877 and 1886. These methods brought major successes in 1911 to 1913, and the organization grew both in numbers and notoriety. Like the earlier class-oriented labor movements in the previous four decades, the IWW aroused strong emotions. Its clientele were the lowest level of workers, poorly skilled, largely propertyless with little hope of ever becoming property owners, many of them recent immigrants. Its philosophy was overtly socialist, but it was not the genteel ideology of the Socialist Party with its emphasis on democratic political action, reform, and gradualism. Much of the IWW's rhetoric was fiery, and its tactics were unsettling to many. A hostile press attacked the organization in cartoons and editorials, and news stories were often distorted in an effort to create an impression that the IWW stood for lawlessness, destruction, and anarchy. The leadership preached nonviolence and passive resistance, but that strategy was hard to sustain when company police, strikebreakers, local police, and the National Guard attacked IWW meetings. The class warfare that the IWW advocated, when it came, was not peaceful. The IWW was under attack from its origin. All of the methods developed since 1877 were used by a coalition of business corporations, much of the press, local and state courts, and local and state governments. The federal government was not involved, for the most part, until it entered the fray to apply the coup de grace in 1918. The attack on the IWW began with a spectacular and unsuccessful show trial in 1906. Former Governor Frank Stunenberg, who had a leading role in breaking a WFM strike in the Coeur d'Alene mining district in 1899, was murdered in Caldwell, Idaho on December 30, 1905. The murderer was quickly apprehended, one Harry Orchard, who was induced to implicate four officials of the WFM. Three of them, Charles Boyer, William D. Haywood, and George A. Pettibone, who was then no longer associated with the union, were arrested in Colorado, extradited under highly dubious procedures, which were later upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, and taken to Idaho under guard. It amounted to a legalized kidnapping. None of the accused had been in Idaho at the time of the crime, but, in a variation on the Haymarket trial, were accused of conspiring with Orchard to kill Stunenberg. A series of spectacular trials followed, in which the two chief legal adversaries were state, later U.S., Senator William A. Borah and the famous trial lawyer, Clarence Darrow. All three of the defendants were acquitted, but the trials were an expensive drain on the union treasury. The press was able to create an image of the WFM and IWW as lawless, violent organizations, and much of the leadership of the two organizations was immobilized for 2 years. The forces of repression won a partial victory, even though the trials were lost. The IWW's free speech conflicts in 1909 to 1912 were directed against denial of constitutional rights by local governments and business-inspired vigilantes. The IWW found that the best way to organize migratory and seasonal workers in industries like lumbering or agriculture was to sponsor speeches and meetings on city streets in locations where such workers congregated. Success with these tactics in Spokane, Washington, in 1909, brought a city ordinance prohibiting such meetings by revolutionists, but not by religious organizations like the Salvation Army. defiance of the ordinance led to mass arrests and jail, then to police brutality, and then suppression of the IWW newspaper and headquarters. A new IWW office in Idaho was illegally raided by the Spokane police. Finally, after 2 years of conflict, the tactics of nonviolent opposition won. The financial cost of repression was becoming burdensome to the local government. Spokane's government agreed to allow indoor meetings, permit publications of the IWW newspaper and its sale on city streets, and to pass a satisfactory free speech ordinance. In short, to respect the U.S. Constitution. The jailed IWW leaders were released. Other free speech fights in the West were won by the IWW, but not in San Diego. There, the city government worked closely with local vigilantes organized by business interests. IWW leaders and organizers were arrested by the police, taken into the desert, and turned over to vigilantes, beaten, and then left to fend for themselves. A state investigation, the governor was Democratic progressive Hiram Johnson, confirmed the connivance of city officials with the vigilante guerrillas. The IWW persisted in its organizing despite the brutality, and city officials finally asked for help from the federal government to destroy this organization which, they claimed, sought to overthrow the government. The U.S. Attorney General refused to act, however, even though President Taft, trying to win California votes in the 1912 election, supported federal intervention. But by the end of 1912, the IWW will to resist was broken. Volunteers for continued passive resistance could not be obtained in the face of unremitting brutality on the part of vigilantes supported by local officials. A variety of police tactics were employed against the IWW during strikes. In Goldfield, Nevada, in 1907 to 1908, at a time when the leaders of the WFM and IWW were on trial in Idaho and a growing split was developing between moderates and radicals in the WFM and IWW, the mining companies decided to reduce wages and break the local unions. But they could not rely on local government authorities for help because the unions and workers were strong in local politics, and Nevada had no National Guard. So the companies conspired with the governor to ask for federal troops, fabricating stories of local violence to justify the action. President Roosevelt, initially deceived, complied, and even when informed of the deceit, kept the army in Goldfield. This action enabled the mining companies to force a wage reduction and institute quote-unquote yellow dog contracts, in which workers agreed not to join a union. Simultaneously, the AFL sent in organizers in opposition to the WFM and IWW, but made little progress. The pattern of using government police action was repeated in most of the strikes in which the IWW was active, particularly after some early successes in 1907 to 1908 in the lumber industry in the Pacific Northwest and in eastern industrial plants in Schenectady, New York, Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Skowhegan, Maine. In 1909, at McKees Rocks, Pennsylvania, unskilled and mostly immigrant workers continued to strike at the Pressed Steel Car Company after the skilled workers had settled. At this point, the IWW entered the scene and took over leadership of the strike. There had already been violence between workers and strikebreakers, and more followed after the entry of the IWW as the immigrant workers massed to prevent strikebreakers from entering the plant. Private company police, local sheriff's deputies, and units of the Pennsylvania State Police combined to support the strikebreakers. Homes were searched to confiscate weapons under a state law that forbade aliens to own weapons. But the attempt at repression did not succeed in this instance. The company quickly settled on terms favorable to the workers, largely for fear that continuation of the strike would strengthen radicalism among its workers and others in the Pittsburgh area. The tactic of using police, backed up by courts, was soon extended. The IWW started its official publication, Solidarity, in Pittsburgh in 1909, following the strike at McKees Rocks. local authorities immediately arrested its entire staff. IWW-inspired strikes at Newcastle and Butler, Pennsylvania, were quickly suppressed by vigorous managements in combination with local police and courts. In the southern lumbering areas of Louisiana and East Texas, the lumber companies employed their own gunmen to terrorize union organizers and the IWW, action that could continue only under a program of benign neglect on the part of local authorities. And several IWW organizers were arrested and charged with crimes committed by company thugs. They were later acquitted. In Lawrence, Massachusetts, in 1912, where the IWW was called in to lead a spontaneous strike and won an outstanding victory, much of the violence was provoked by company management and the police, and was then used as an excuse for further repression. The strike began in January, and the first act of violence came when workers spontaneously smashed machinery and windows in one textile mill. This was followed 3 days later by a clash between strikers and local police, reinforced by state militia, in which the police and militia were clearly the aggressors. 5 days later, the police, acting on tips, found dynamite at several locations, and a hue and cry against the strike and the IWW were raised in the press. But the dynamite was soon traced to a local businessman who admitted he had sought to discredit the strike. He was tried and fined. Shortly afterwards, it was disclosed that the American Woolen Co., largest of the local firms, had arranged for the dynamite incident at the suggestion of the company president, who escaped punishment. Late in January, police interfered with an IWW parade. An officer was stabbed and a woman striker was shot and killed. This was the incident needed by the police. The two IWW strike leaders, Joseph Etter and Arturo Giovanniti, were charged with conspiracy in the murder, arrested, and jailed. The purpose, of course, was to deprive the strike of its leadership. But this tactic failed. The IWW sent in other leaders, including William Haywood, and ultimately Etter and Giovanniti were acquitted. Meanwhile, the strike leadership hit on a tactic designed to arouse public sympathy and raise funds for the strike. They began a program of sending children of the strikers to foster homes elsewhere, accompanied by great publicity. The success of this program caused the local officials in Lawrence to prohibit any further movement of the children, a clearly illegal action by the authorities. When the IWW continued the practice, the police, on February 24th, attacked a group of women and children at the Lawrence Railroad Station, beating and clubbing them as they were arrested and hauled off in a National Guard truck. This stupid act of brutality, in full view of the press, brought victory to the strikers. The governor of Massachusetts, who early in the strike had unsuccessfully tried to mediate, trying to prevent the radicalism from gaining a foothold, ordered an investigation. The U.S. House of Representatives began an investigation, as did the U.S. Bureau of Labor. Many progressive political leaders expressed support for the strikers. What had started out as a class war between right-wing capitalists and left-wing labor threatened to forge a coalition between left-wing labor and reformist liberal elements. At this point, the companies settled the strike on terms highly favorable to the workers. The IWW now had some 20,000 members in Lawrence alone, but in the longer run, the employers won, using more subtle tactics to split the labor force. Labor spies, discrimination against union members and leaders, favoring some nationality groups over others in promotion policy, hiring non-union workers, and so on. The strike mobilized the unskilled immigrant workers, but the union was unable to withstand continuing employer pressure over the next few years. The IWW victory at Lawrence was followed by defeats at Paterson, New Jersey, and elsewhere. The repressive measures that had boomeranged at Lawrence were used more successfully elsewhere. Employers used strikebreakers, assisted by local police and courts, and by the state government where the National Guard was needed. The IWW leaders were special targets. Police riots in which strikers and strike leaders were beaten were common occurrences. Vigilantes were organized for further violence beyond the pretense of legality, while police looked the other way. IWW leaders, most of whom preached nonviolent mass action, were tried for the violence for which employers and police were largely responsible. Among the more highly publicized incidents were the murder trial of Joe Hill in Salt Lake City in 1914, the Bloody Sunday massacre in Everett, Washington in 1916, and the vigilante lynching of Frank Little in Butte, Montana in 1917. In Jerome, Arizona in July 1917, the copper companies organized armed vigilantes who, quote, cleared the town of agitators, end quote, by seizing any wobblies they could find and deporting them to the middle of the Mojave Desert in California. They then turned their attention to the local miners' union affiliated with the AFL and drove it out also. Inspired by this success, a similar operation on a much larger scale was carried out a week later in Bisbee, Arizona. Through most of this turmoil, the federal government remained neutral. State governments tended not to get involved directly, and the chief repressive measures were left to local governments and courts. Meanwhile, there was movement at the federal level toward legislation that promoted collective bargaining and trade agreements, and toward recognition of labor unions as the bargaining representatives of workers. The Erdman Act of 1898 provided for collective bargaining on railroads, but had been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court 10 years later. Legislation in 1913 created a separate U.S. Department of Labor with full cabinet status and established a full-time board of conciliation and arbitration in the new department to deal with labor management disputes on railroads. The Clayton Act of 1914 exempted labor unions from the provisions of the Sherman Act. Although written in a manner that did not fully protect unions from injunctions based on the Sherman Act, this was important legislation, for in the Danbury Hatters case, 1908, and Buck's Stove and Range case, 1909, the U.S. Supreme Court had interpreted the Sherman Act in a manner that could be used to destroy unions altogether. In 1915, federal legislation regulated conditions of work for seamen. The Adamson Act of 1916 provided for an 8-hour day and time and a half for overtime on interstate railroads, an important victory for labor. On other fronts, the cloak and suit industry in New York began to develop its machinery for arbitration of labor disputes in 1910 to 1912. Massachusetts passed the first minimum wage law for women and minors in 1912 after the great IWW strike at Lawrence, and New York passed the first workers' compensation legislation. Federal legislation in 1916 barred products of child labor from interstate commerce, but was declared unconstitutional in 1918. A new act in 1919 had a similar fate in 1922. Much other pro-labor legislation failed in both Congress and state legislatures, but there clearly was progress on two fronts: ameliorative legislation to aid working people, and legislation to promote collective bargaining. During World War I, promotion of collective bargaining between unions and management became federal policy. A mediation commission was established in 1917. In 1918, the National War Labor Board and the War Labor Policies Board were established. The first was a court of last resort to settle labor disputes. The second sought to standardize labor conditions as a means of promoting labor peace. During the war, federal purchasing agencies generally insisted that suppliers bargain collectively with their employees. This policy brought large increases in union membership. AFL unions added over 2 million members, and other unions, including a rash of company unions organized by employers to comply with federal policies, added another 250,000. All of these programs were closed out when the war ended, and conservative business opinion and its anti-union policies were once more dominant. But the labor policies of 1917 to 1918, which were a development of those that had emerged in the anthracite strike of 1902, were a forerunner of the national policies that became firmly established in the 1930s. The IWW shared in the union growth engendered by wartime prosperity in spite of repression. Its membership grew from perhaps 40,000 in 1916 to over 100,000, it claimed 250,000, just before its suppression in 1917. The organization was particularly strong among the migratory farm workers of the Great Plains states, in the copper mining areas of Montana and Arizona, and the Northwest lumber industry. It grew in spite of a renewed drive of legalized union busting. By the end of 1917, federal troops were on duty in the mining areas of Montana and Arizona, the lumbering areas of Oregon and Western Washington, and the wheat-growing territories of Eastern Washington, even though there had been no violence there and no trace of German espionage could be found.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.